This episode of the Coin Spice Podcast is brought to you by Cash Shuffle, because what you do with your money is your business. To give this new product a try for fungibility and privacy, head on over to electroncash.org, download their latest wallet 4.0.0, and give it a spin. CashShuffle.com for more information, because what you do with your money is your business.
What is really going on, crypto savages? You are listening to the Coin Spice Podcast with host C. Edward Kelso, editor-in-chief at coinspice.io, your home for spicy crypto things on the net.
So very much for doing this. We really appreciate you coming on. And, you know, let's sort of, I guess, start from the beginning. You're a professor out at NYU, right?
In media, culture, and communication.
So it's not, I guess, immediately clear as to how an NYU professor in the media side, culture and communication, would find something like cryptocurrency. So before we get into the particulars of the book itself, how did you sort of stumble upon this idea?
Well, there's actually, I know everyone says this kind of thing, but I think there's actually kind of an interesting story behind this. I was originally trained as a historian of technology. And I kind of moved laterally over into media studies because a lot of the technology that I was interested in was digital technology and the development of computing systems and the development of the internet and things like that. And as it turned out, thinking of those as media was a great way to be able to study them and work on them and to think about how they evolved and what they mean. But from the very earliest days in my own training, when I was going through like a doctoral program, I was working on some, you know, disastrous dissertation projects that never went anywhere. But one thread that ran through them was that I was really interested in doing the histories of technologies that we don't even necessarily notice or don't think about. Like, I had this long time obsession with knots, you know, like knotting things is like one of the most primeval human technological activities, and it enables so many other things, but it's largely invisible to us. And one of the things that fascinated me in knots as a technology was how they were used as mechanisms to track things like debt and credit and systems of property. And yeah, so every technology that I would sort of stumble across that I was working on over the course of years and years, you know, that all touched in one way or another on media, that could all somehow be used to store information or transmit information, there was usually someone somewhere in some context who had tried to figure out how to either use those as money or use them as a ledger system for money. So in the back of my mind, there was always this kind of sense of like, I really want to write about money at some point, you know, because like money is such a fascinating technology and it's such a fascinating medium, like both in the kind of strict econ medium of exchange sense, but also in the more general sense of something that carries a huge amount of information and enables a whole lot of different kinds of information exchange across time and space. So I knew there was like something there and I could never find quite the right hook for it. And I had also, and this is kind of just the other more personal part of it, I was born and raised in the Bay Area. And I was a very kind of starry-eyed, you know, utopian kid as the sort of very early days of Usenet and the internet and so on were taking place around me. And I remembered as I was, you know, kind of getting a little bit older, like that there had been all this talk about how we were going to have these new forms of commerce. But not just new forms of commerce in the sense of Amazon, we were going to have new forms of currency that would enable things like microtransactions and the ability to sort of freely engage in person-to-person commerce across national boundaries, around the planet, across different currency regimes. And I always had this kind of nagging feeling of like, whatever happened to all of those projects? So then when we cut to like 2008, 2009, because I've been doing a lot of work related to cryptography and the history of digital cryptography, I'm also kind of on the edges of those mailing lists where people are sort of kicking the original Nakamoto paper around. And I just remember kind of having this moment of being like, yes, here it is. Like not just in the sense of like being excited about Bitcoin as such, although I was really fascinated by it, but also like, here's the hook, you know, finally I have like the framework, the story where I can tie together like the all of these sort of like utopian projects of the 1980s and 90s with the present day, with this like deeper history of looking at money as a medium and money as a technology. And then I spent the last 8 years or so kind of off and on trying to figure out how to weave all that together.
I love, one of the things I really appreciate about your way of thinking is as a non-economist in the strict, you know, sort of parochial sense of that word, you give it a very human element. So it's not that you can't talk about, you know, econometrics or, you know, other aspects, technical aspects of the idea, but that you bring to it this historical, that money itself, as we're finding now, especially in the cryptocurrency world and kind of the inside baseball tribalism that goes on here, it's very human, like unbelievably human technology. I'm sure you're, you know, more than aware of that, but it's, I love how you really do put that on. So just stepping back for a second. So you kind of come out of, you know, I don't want to put a black hat on you, of course, but you sort of come out of those hacker circles. So if I said things like 2600 to you, you wouldn't be like, what? And if I said hope to you, right, you'd understand what I was talking about, right?
Yeah. I've taken naps on those incredibly grody carpeted floors at the hotel where the event happens.
So you've actually, I'm, you know, being coy here because we talked about it a little bit, and that's, I think, where I first discovered you, but you've actually given talks at Hackers on Planet Earth and so on, right?
Yes, yeah, and that was such an enormous help to me, and it's something that I still often kind of think about as a good starting point for like maybe some kind of interesting ways to talk about what we talk about when we talk about cryptocurrencies, like to kind of frame that conversation in a way that also goes back to what you were saying about looking at money as a human thing, as a human project. Because so you know, someone who became a tremendous kind of guide for me was Hyman Minsky, who's a great monetary economist, and he at one point in his kind of, you know, very definitive guide to like how to study monetary economics, he says like anyone can create money. You know, the challenge is getting anyone else to accept it. And we talk about, and I don't mean this to sound like a classic kind of like freshman dorm stoner thing where it's like money doesn't have any real value, but rather that it's actually really fruitful to
it's all just
look at
a dream. Yeah, simulation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we're gonna just red pill you and you'll realize that this is, you know, all yeah. But to that point, like there's actually something that's really interesting about looking, like especially when we have this really extraordinary moment that we're living through right now, where we get to have kind of a ringside seat to the invention of a lot of new kinds of money tokens and currency systems, which is that we get to watch not only the kind of, you know, sophistication, the technical work that goes into building the system, but also into the human conversation that has to happen around why you should accept this, around why you should buy into this, around why we should all kind of join into one particular project or another. And another venue where that kind of conversation happens in a really interesting way is hacking. And like hacking in the, you know, sort of larger open source and free software sense, as well as in the kind of, you know, exploits and security flaws sense, right?
Exactly,
where like
exactly.
Part of what makes open source work is like all of those human conversations about like, sure, we can build X, we can build Y. Why should we all try to build Y instead of X? Because if we end up splitting in half, it's going to be a mess. You know, there's a million projects out there with one poor committer on Git, you know? So yeah. So how do we kind of create that, that sense of mission, of vision, of, I mean, even if I can put it this way, of like, of utopia, you know, of like a bigger thing to work towards that will provide the incentive for people to start to kind of buy into, getting back to money, this particular platform of value.
And these guys and gals are, you know, in the 2600 hope circles, like a cypherpunk progeny, they're tinkerers, they're go of things type people, so that like hacking, I guess, I was gonna belittle it and say most people just think of it as sitting in front of a computer and trying to send nuclear bombs somewhere. But hacking really, it actually has become, you know, hack your diet and all sorts of stuff. But
yeah,
hacking back then was actually that, where they were as much about social engineering and just walking into places that they shouldn't. They don't want to steal anything. There's yeah, absolutely no nefarious anything. These guys and gals just want to know the goal. Like, I can't, you know, there's a rope and I can't, well, why not? And
yeah,
I bet you I can go back there. And just the knowledge, there was, I remember these times, and it still exists. And this culture that we're talking about presently is certainly an outgrowth of that. But I remember it not being so specified, that it was this, I want to know the go of everything, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it, actually. Yeah, because it does. It was like this larger attitude of how can we more freely explore in order to better understand, you know? Like, how can we, why is it that so much of the way that the telephone monopoly at the time functions a secret? Not because we want to, you know, as it kind of subsequently developed this bad reputation for, as you say, like, you know, remote activating nuclear weapons, or, you know, like prank, you know, doing some kind of next level prank calling or whatever, but literally from the outset, like, how can we better like work our way through this enormous, amazing machine so that we can understand it, so that we can appreciate how this works, and that
getting
heart,
rid of the gatekeepers, or
yes,
or going around gatekeepers, right?
Yes, absolutely. And that is so much the attitude that I think is like kind of the best part of hacking, like that sense of approaching any given technology from this perspective of like this, you know, I want to learn how this works. I want to understand what this means. I want to see what kinds of things, like a lot of the earliest hacks, and this does kind of tie into cryptocurrency in some really interesting ways. A lot of the earliest hacks, some of them were kind of more like pranks, but a lot of them were also like demonstrations of what you could do that only a handful of other people would really appreciate. But they would appreciate it on a really deep level because it meant that you like got this system, you know? And as you say, a lot of it was also based around exploring and exploiting sometimes the like human dimensions of these yeah, things. And, you know, at the risk of doing that kind of very professorial thing where you use basically a pun or like a coincidence of words to link two concepts, I think there's a lot of early hacking is about confidence. You know, it's about sort of getting other people's confidence, whether that's getting people to contribute to a project or like playing basically confidence games, you know, as a way of doing that kind of social engineering that you describe. And a lot of, especially the early days of cryptocurrency, is also kind of a confidence game, sometimes in the negative, but mostly in the positive sense, you know, like how do you yeah, sort of win people over and kind of get them to understand what this could be capable of once you start to think about it, once you start to really explore the underlying technology of money.
And it goes, this way of thinking permeated literally everything from walking through, you probably couldn't do this now actually, in the early 90s, say Dinkins NYC era, just before Giuliani, you could actually find these abandoned subway arteries,
yes,
you know, and just yeah, sort of discover them. They're these beautiful, you know, sort of, you know, worlds down there. And then, you know, you a guy would write into 2600 and he said, oh, you know what? I stumbled upon this idea where, you know, this is the, sort of the juvenile aspect. He was taking the old Scantron test, you know, where you would use the number two
yeah,
and you bubble in. And he would take chapstick and he mistakenly put it against that that reader element. And then when the professor or the teacher went to scan it, it would, you know, mark them all correct. And so he sort of covered, you know what I mean? Like, you know, people say, yeah. Oh, you can't have this information out. You know, you should know this, you know? And the sort of the pornography for us, like you say, is the confidence idea, but also the sort of the nerd porno was, and people are going to find this hard to believe, especially if you've never seen 2600, they would take pictures of phone booths.
Yeah.
These were our centerfolds, you know, like, ooh, look at that, you know, Czechoslovakian, you know, fun. Like how on earth would you use a Captain Crunch whistle on that, you know? And
yeah, exactly. Yeah, phone booths and padlocks and like manhole covers and all these things that are about like mechanisms of access and mechanisms of denial, you know, and like how do you kind of like turn one into the other, basically.
Yeah, so that was kind of a long way to go, and I drew you out on tangent on purpose, but so you're there to 0809. You're there, you see the white paper, lots of bells go off. 10 years later, we've got a book printed with the Princeton University Press called Digital Cash, where you actually go into the history of it. Was kind of everything working towards this book? I saw in one of your lectures, you described yourself as a money geek, where you actually had a picture of yourself in front of...
yes, in New Hampshire, in front of the sign for where the Bretton Woods conference was held.
Exactly.
which is truly a odd piece of tourism, but no, it was, well, like the this became my kind of background obsession. Like it was one of those things where I've written a couple of other books in the interim that were all kind of, you know, bird in hand, like existing projects. But this became my kind of deep abiding fascination. And I think, you know, in kind of the spirit of 2600 and Hackers on Planet Earth, part of what I really got into was, you know, in the same way that like you could start by being like, you know, how does the telephone work? And then kind of end up 10 years later, you know, like navigating through relays across the planet, like Captain Crunch famously could do, or building a modem or what have you. I started out with just this kind of real interest in like, you know, how does this cryptocurrency thing unite with the previous ways that people have used technology to transact. They've used like kind of different forms of payment, storage, et cetera, around money. And that kind of slowly morphed into, just like a learning more and more about it and becoming fascinated with the history of central banking and the history of how currency itself is protected, right? Like all of the amazingly weird tech that has to go into securing paper notes, like all of that work and the kind of secretive network of companies that are in this space, the history of counterfeiting, cultures around like coinage and how you make coins. This is actually, I'm a very nerdy guy, and this might be the nerdiest thing about me, is I slowly transformed into like a kind of amateur numismatist. Because coins are a great way to do history, and numismatics is the study of coins as historical objects. And so I started reading all these like super technical journals where people are like going through the recovered Gotland coin hoard and figuring out how to like use coins to prove, which you can, which is amazing, that like through this record of transactions, we can demonstrate that like this kingdom was under the control of this ruler at this point, but also that merchants had traveled to this place and blah, blah, blah. Like I just got into it. And it you know, if you ask any of my friends, it made me really difficult, like even more than the D&D phase, it made me a really difficult person to be around sometimes.
Well, it's the king of interdisciplinary studies, I believe. And that it really does. It is a shame, and this is another conversation for another time, as to what economics has become in, the way that I've from afar as a layman have understood it, that it's so divorced from that human element that it's just sort of broken down into charts and indices and the major movements of governments and so on. That's why I love your book and the way that you think about the world with regard to especially cryptocurrencies. But you, Bitcoin in as far as our focus here, CoinSplice, it doesn't appear ex nihilo, right? Like you've kind of gone into the fact and alluded to the fact that, you know, money has sort of obviously evolved. And I think most people understand that. But this digital cash idea, this peer to peer electronic form of it, that doesn't just drop out of nothingness.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the really interesting things that you realize when you start kind of working backwards through all of those, you know, many of these will not necessarily be news to your listeners. You know, they're often kind of like names or precedents that come up in the conversation around Bitcoin. But to kind of see them one after another, it's really striking to realize that you can actually start to see not necessarily enormous technological leaps forward, even though, I mean, there were absolutely advances, sometimes very significant ones. But more than that, there were actually changes in attitude. You know, there were like different agendas behind how the technologies were implemented. You know, we can see a lot of precedents, including some really direct technical precedents for what, you know, Bitcoin began as, and obviously it's, you know, evolved a great deal subsequently. But we can see those precedents in the work that Hal Finney was doing around reusable proof of work tokens, you know, Nick Szabo, Wei Dai, all the way back to, you know, David Chaum and Ralph Merkel. But as we, with each of those, we see like a different approach to the idea of what money is, and therefore how the system should be designed to produce that, right? So like, you know, David Chaum is this really fascinating person, and I go into his work a lot in the book, but he's the guy who coins the term and the concept of digital cash, and he has a company that really almost introduced a really sort of extraordinarily fleshed out version of these ideas for a censorship resistant anonymous digital currency, except that for Chaum, all of the mechanisms that he designs are based around the idea that you are as it were withdrawing an existing territorial currency, you know, like US dollars, just as you would from an ATM, except you're withdrawing them in digital form rather than cash form. So they function exactly like cash, like they, you know, if they have no connection to your identity, there's no ledger reference for them. If you lose them, they're gone. If someone steals them from you, they're gone. And there's no record of the transaction between yourself and the merchant. Like you pay them just as you would cash in hand, and the money verifies itself, and there's no recourse to your identity. And a lot of those elements should really ring bells for us in the cryptocurrency world now, except that for Chaum, the goal of this was never to create a new currency. It was simply to provide a digital framework for transactions in existing currency. And so when you look at something like that, you can kind of see how like, oh, he's using a lot of similar technologies, but he's using them for a completely different approach than the idea of something like Bitcoin, where the transaction system is also its own bank and produces its own unique currency.
Yeah, and so he missed it, you know, depending on how you look at it, but he either missed it by a country mile or he was just so close.
Yes, yeah. I'm kind of in the so close side of things. I feel like he was like, he actually has these amazing remarks where he gave congressional testimony about the sort of need to develop these new systems, and along with talking about stuff that I think feels really prescient now. You know, like he talks about the threats to censorship that, or the threats of censorship that can be imposed through being able to block people from being able to engage in certain kinds of transactions, and the temptation that having electronic ledger money is going to create for powerful institutions by being able to do things like figure, like learn stuff about people through their transaction metadata, you know, and being able to you know, exploit know your customer requirements to, like, you know, block, well, we can, you know, all of this, all of the examples of this should spring immediately to mind. There's a million versions of it, but he was so well aware of it. But he also warned, like, in the 90s, that if we don't get electronic currencies established in a way that meets certain fundamental requirements like anonymity, like censorship resistance, then the network is going to route around existing currencies and create their own. And he really predicts a lot of the different things that end up kind of coming into play. So I think he was a guy who was like really, really, really close to what it was going to become. But part of the challenge, getting back to talking about hackers and confidence and so on, part of the challenge that he faced was that, as he put it, like he was asking society to engage in a major fundamental change. Like there just wasn't, as it were, like enough buy-in. He was just so early, you know, like there wasn't enough buy-in even to the idea of the internet, you know, much less like the kind of sophistication that we saw develop in the next 30 years around like engaging in online transactions and buying and selling data of all different kinds. Like he was kind of inventing all of that stuff himself. So one of the questions that really raises for me is like, how do we think about how the context of digital cash has changed? And what can that maybe tell us about things like where Bitcoin came from, but also where it might be going next?
And, you know, it's something that I wanted to talk about anyway, but I think when I hear about him going to Congress, and the way I'm going to characterize it is probably very, very unfair, but asking for permission and here's what we need to do, you know, sort of in the ultimate sense. In a way, I'm glad Congress and government did what it's best at, which is ignore reality. and so the anarchists, which again is a very broad brush, I think right now there is an attempt in 2019, because there's so much institutional money coming into crypto, either directly through speculation with regard to derivatives and futures markets. ICE, for goodness sakes, is backing, is bringing on backed fairly soon, talk of ETFs and so on. And I've seen the discussion just in the last 10 years go from this peer-to-peer digital cash medium of exchange, be your own bank talk, to now, I cannot wait until, you know, Wall Street comes in and dumps all this. It's such a change.
Yeah.
There's an attempt to divorce Bitcoin from its very anarchic roots. It's in the first part of your subtitle, The Unknown History of the Anarchist, comma, and you go on, I really appreciate you putting them there. And I'm not sure if that was just alphabetical or this sounded better. But what kind of role then, if I'm not skipping too far or too, you know, jumping around too much, what kind of role do anarchists play in its development, and are they critical, important, or do you find them kind of goofy? And
no, they're hugely important. You know, I mean, I have my disagreements with them, of course, as they did, you know, among themselves. Like the joke, which I experienced firsthand, you know, that any gathering of, you know, anarchists, libertarians, etc., is going to have N+1 versions of, you know, their beliefs. It's always going to be like, you know, whenever you think you have identified all of the different subcategories, there's always like another page on the wiki for a new version of something. And that was absolutely true of that, you know, even in the kind of relatively early days. But I mean, for me, one of the things that is most interesting as a historian is that when we look at how something like Bitcoin came into being, we can actually see a real clash of ideas at work, you know, as well. Like it's one thing to like, which, you know, I really enjoy, because it's one thing to kind of look at like the history of money in the 20th century, a lot of which is the history of, you know, territorial currencies, geopolitics, and central banking, which is tremendously important and fascinating in a sense, but also can lack a certain fire, you know, the general consensus about how these things should be run and the mechanisms by which they should be run and blah, blah, blah. And this is a space where you can see people really articulately going at it hammer and tongs, not just about, you know, anarchism versus socialism versus libertarianism versus status quo, but actually about within those different areas, like what is the set of ideas that's best suited to being developed in these new technologies? And like that's in some ways a really rare, precious opportunity to see that kind of, to be so close to the forge, you know, at the moment where people are bringing their deeply held, passionate beliefs and very, you know, kind of thought through theories of society and history and the future, and then saying, how can we build a kind of money that will bear these out? And the ways that, you know, and again, not to tread on any toes necessarily, but the ways in which a lot of contemporary crypto is like watching, you know, it's like watching someone who's like, you know, trying to really go straight, you know, like they come from some really family of, you know, really unusual people, bohemians and artists and radicals and renegades. And then just trying to be like, let nobody talk about Uncle Tim May, you know, let's just pretend that didn't happen. And let's all kind of, yeah. We're all about like trying to really find a way to create like really reliable settlement mechanisms for your interbank finance needs.
Really,
it's kind of strange because there's like we put anarchists first because they came first in the story, but now all of that is now being like kind of papered over a little bit.
It is interesting. I love it when there'll be conferences and they'll sort of reintroduce the PGP arguments and bring in like the Whitfield Diffies of the world. And, you know, people sit down and have to learn about Phil Zimmerman and his fight with the Clinton administration over, you know, basic encryption and all these ideas where it is interesting that right now in the space we're seeing in the cryptocurrency space, I really don't think we anticipated exchanges, crypto exchanges, to play such, you know, the major role that they've begun to play. And also that they're now, they're sort of, they kind of get it. Like they're trying to do what Chalm was trying to do in the 90s, which was sort of headed off at the pass, I guess, in a way, and kind of, you know, a shapeshift, and some of these other companies now are actually, you know, implementing KYC, AML into their formerly go-go hyper-capitalist, anarcho-capitalist, you know, to not, you know, get jail time or lose the entire project. It is super interesting. How do you as a historian see that? Like you sort of like laugh at it because it is silly. I mean, it's the hippie, you know, taking the Series 7 and working for Goldman at some point, right?
Yes, yeah. No, it's. I mean, on one level, I think I have to confess that I'm not at all surprised. You know, like there's and you know, kind of thinking in more historical terms, it's really difficult for a technology, especially a new technology of this kind, to essentially the ones that stayed radical, we've never heard of. And I try to like bring some of them back in the book because of the fact that they couldn't get the kind of traction that made it possible for them to really, you know, like find their footing and become institutionalized. And especially when you're talking about something like money. Well, I actually have a larger thought about this that I'll get to in a second. But you know, I think a lot about people like Carlotta Perez, who I'd love to give a shout out for your listeners, who's a fantastic historian of industrial booms, and in particular of like high-tech industries, like how they kind of go through their heyday, how they expand, how they get institutionalized. And she's really kind of worked out I think a really reliable periodization of what happens with those kinds of things. And the kind of frustrating answer is that the process in the 20th and 21st centuries whereby you build a big business and like get a technology off the ground is a process of structural co-optation You know, and that doesn't have to do with any kind of like, you know, Marxist inevitability of whatever. It more has to do with like the kinds of business and institutional mechanisms that we've built, you know, where at a certain point you like the people who can get the money to build the PR campaigns, to like run the really reliable infrastructure, to sort of win over, you know, existing institutions with their bona fides, means that they're the people who are pulling in a ton of investment, means that they're the people who are now like culpable and heavily involved with having to deliver certain kinds of results. Like they get normalized. And they get normalized in really swift ways. It's hard to stay radical for long, especially when you're looking at something like a new high technology system. Like we can also look at things like the Gartner hype cycle, which is such a great chart and which I think really holds water as a predictive mechanism, where basically you have like, you know, the peak of inflated expectations, and then you have like the trough of disillusion, and then you have the plateau of productivity, you know, and they've given these things these names, but they actually map out how different technologies kind of go through these phases. And the sad fact is the plateau of productivity is usually a pretty boring place. And it's also a very disappointing one in terms of how things get sort of brought in and institutionalized. However, in the long term, one of the things that's really interesting to me about things like Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies is that the era of the territorial currency, right? Like the kind of classic, when I say classic, I actually mean recent, but the mechanism by which that we're all pretty used to, right? Like nations print currencies, like they operate in floating markets of exchange against each other.
Right.
And we kind of transact across them. And once in a while, some kind of major new thing happens, like the Euro block or what have you. That's a pretty recent development. In terms of like long-term human history, that's like shockingly recent, actually. You know, it's something that really comes together and fits and starts only in, you know, the last, like it's less than 200 years old. And it's really interesting to look at cryptocurrencies in the long run as being things that are, you know, going through this phase right now, this somewhat disillusioning phase of being so swiftly kind of incorporated into existing mechanisms in ways that don't seem to be taking full advantage of their capabilities. But in the longer term, like I think it's more than possible. In fact, I think it's fairly likely that the period of territorial currency as we knew it is an interlude. And it's an interlude between the much longer term history of money and finance, which is a history of a variety of different kinds of money all interacting together. And I'd be happy to go into way more detail about that. But it's to say that when we look at the really society-changing effects of cryptocurrencies, we need to remember that if these things really work as monetary technologies, we need to think about them over the much longer term. You know, and I think they will have some very radical effects, but they're not going to have them in that kind of revolutionary short cycle that I think a lot of us were feeling in 2008, 2009, 2010, when it's the middle of the global financial crisis, you know, like, yeah. And WikiLeaks is happening. And everyone is kind of in that moment of like, oh my God, all the pieces have aligned. This is the opening to a new order of things. And that it didn't kind of pan out that way, but that doesn't mean that it's not having a longer, slower term effect and creating systems that are ready for adoption when we get ready to move out of the phase of currency regimes that we're in now.
And there, it's funny how prescient your comments are, because obviously there's a trade war with China going on presently, and lots of talk about the yuan. And, you know, it's notorious, you know, manipulation schemes. And it's funny to hear the U.S. talk about that as if they have U.S. currency.
Yeah.
I always laugh under my breath when I see it. But, you know, point taken. We just printed something about this on CoinSpice, or published rather, the Malaysian head of state, whose name escapes me right now, the oldest executive in chief, geez, I'm losing it here. The oldest, I guess, sort of head politician in the world, 93 years old. He was sort of lamenting the East Asian trade as being so easily manipulatable in the sense that you're speaking of, because all these currencies float on exchanges and guys like, well, he named George Soros, but that's an easy foil. You know, there are obviously, you know, people who want to and institutions that want to game them. And so he suggested, you know, going back to gold, not as a domestic, you know, backing or, you know, one-to-one or pegging, but for a trading block within East Asia so as to prevent sort of smaller economies like Malaysia as being gamed by these guys. So I find that super interesting that you're saying that it kind of all kind of comes back and we're going from these sectarian, you know, nation state currencies, maybe back to something a little bit more global. Do you have any thoughts on, you know, we're here at CoinSpice, we're partisan to the cash side. So we like Bitcoin Cash as opposed to, say, Bitcoin, which is known as ticker symbol BTC, and it's become sort of this, as far as their enthusiasts are concerned, digital gold and a store of value. We're more interested in the medium of exchange. Do you have any thoughts on the viability of something like a Bitcoin Cash or something else that its whole modus operandi is to be a sort of world currency, like the hopes for that, or are you saying something kind of completely different?
No, I'm thinking actually very much along those lines. I think the thing that you know, if there are kind of useful lessons from history in this regard, I think it's that there's never one is the thing, you know, like the idea of like a true kind of global currency, you know, aside from a handful of things like precious metals being a classic example, we, prior to the reign of the territorial currency, we see a proliferation of different kinds of mechanisms, all of which sort of coexist with each other in different ways. So you have like actual coins, you know, you have different kinds of specie, but those are actually way, way rarer than, you know, I feel like I kind of have I was really surprised myself when I started reading back into this history in real depth, because I had what I think of as kind of like the D&D effect, which is the assumption that like everyone had just like bags of gold coins, you know, with them, or like they're all kind of exchanging with coins and making change. But like coinage, it turns up in a lot of different contexts, obviously, in lots of different kinds of volumes. But if you were someone who was moving serious money around, then you would do that through things like tally sticks, or bills of exchange, letters of credit, all of these different mechanisms, most of which relied on the idea that they were representations of value that you could transact, that maybe can almost kind of ring some bells for us when we think about things like smart contracts now. But they had relationships to things like big major merchant families, particular cities, institutions, even individuals. And then you had like lots of exchanges in, you know, kind of junk coinage, basically. But then you also had like many kind of smaller communities where people knew each other could run almost entirely on basically like interpersonal debt networks and like kind of kinship relationships and things like that, which were very rigorous and very kind of carefully thought out. They weren't sort of, you know, haphazard IOUs at all. But then when you kind of conjoin that with the fact that even when you look at the coinage and the paper that's moving around, a lot of those are many different kinds of coexisting things. So you have like coins and currencies from multiple countries that are all overlapping in different contexts. And then those are also often flowing alongside what are now called the cash articles, which were like materials, you know, like sort of classic kind of, you know, linen, gunpowder, honey, you know, all kinds of like fairly light, portable, fungible volumes of things. And all that stuff kind of flowed alongside each other. So you would potentially have access to some kind of substantial variety of different kinds of assets that were important for engaging in different kinds of transactions with other people. So you like, you know, you co-own, this is a real thing, not an example, I'm just making up. You can like, you know, co-own a bunch of cows with other people who live in your Swiss canton, and all of those are managed through tally sticks, but you also have coins for small interpersonal transactions, and you have like, you know, a bill of exchange that you've discounted from somebody else that's going to mature at some future date that you use to, you know, buy into some other bigger thing. And then you have, you know, some you have like particular, maybe you have like some stash of jewels or coinage or whatever, if you're a person of significant wealth. And all of those things kind of coexist with each other. So for me, one of the really interesting questions is I absolutely think that cryptocurrencies with more of a focus on I'll be really snarky about this. I think cryptocurrencies, the more of a focus on payment and exchange, really have a lot to offer the world, because most of our systems for payment and transaction are pretty bad in various ways. Especially when we're talking about people who are like having to use remittances or operate across, yes, you know, currency boundaries, things like that. And I really have, I mean, as the book itself conveys, I have a pretty, you know, respectful disagreement with the idea of something like Bitcoin as a, you know, scarce, hoardable, gold-like store of value, for a variety of different reasons. But just kind of one primary one that I'll mention is that if you look at like actually rich people, they have tons of already existing, perfectly functional, scarce, hoardable stores of value. You know, they have real estate and art and actual gold and, you know, all the weird junk that's stashed in like the so-called like, you know, free enterprise zones, like free ports, where you have like these big buildings next to airports, you know, like the one in Geneva, for example, where you can kind of keep off the books, like all of your, you know, appreciating precious assets. Like that's already a well-established mechanism and it works great. And having to build this kind of elaborate technical apparatus to try to produce a digital analog to a scarce physical substance feels like it's kind of missing the point a little bit of what you could do.
Man, preach, brother, preach! Woo! That's so great to hear. And going back to your first point there, which I think is huge because it has become a meme, and there are several projects that have kind of taken up the cash metaphor or mantle, if you will, and they're saying, look, there can only be one, and we get into this Lord of Rings idea, and it's just, it's just ridiculous. I mean, it's just well, in history, that, and like you say, it's sort of a Dungeons and Dragons misnomer in the sense that, you know, only people have used when, I mean, that's just never been the case, and there's no reason to expect that it ever would be. And then why would you like why would you want just you don't want one type of sneakers? I mean, I'm not necessarily, you know, one type of deodorant, you know, one diet, one, you know, so on and so forth. Like it's just better human choice, just especially if it's going to stay, you know, somewhat free of coercion and outside intervention. I mean, you want this stuff to be as blooming and crazy. Like you want what we call shit coins, and then you want sort of viable projects. You want sort of anywhere in between. You want people to experiment, tinker, and as we, you know, kind of the callback here to earlier in the show, you know, kind of walk around the dark parts of subways and figure things out that, you know, we're just not interested in at the moment. But you know, they can, like the Chom fellow, you know, he can see forward, you know, 20, 30 years. You just want all that experimentation going on. So yeah, I'm with you 1000%. Writing when you finished the book, was there something that just like, it just hit you that you were just like, I had no idea about this, and I'm so glad? Like, was there like a main, you know, wham, that moment where you just get, because I know that a lot of academics will sort of stumble down a road because they have sort of assumptions or, you know, things that they want to sort of prove at the outset, kind of, you know, they have the arrow in the tree and they sort of draw the bullseye around it. But I get the sense that you're very playful, where you'll follow an idea And like I said, I was watching you talk about the genesis of the book, you know, for some, you know, almost half a decade ago. So
yeah.
Was there anything that just like, bam, hit you in the head? Like you just did not know that before you started in on the book?
Oh God. Yeah. I mean, for me, like this is not necessarily like a huge, you know, takeaway in terms of thinking about the, you know, the future of digital cash or what have you. But for me, the thing that I like was not anticipating and that I just kind of fell in love with as a research subject was the Extropian movement, who were so much a part of this history and who get so seldom talked about and who were so far out and so kind of, you know, like visionary does not even begin to describe the scale at which they were thinking, right? So this was kind of fairly small community of like philosophically committed techno-utopians in the 80s and 90s. They were very closely connected with the cypherpunk and crypto-anarchist scene. A bunch of them were the same people. They were also like amazingly, like very, very tightly interwoven with the entire early community around Bitcoin. You know, like almost everyone who turns up in the very early days of Bitcoin is also someone who's in the Extropian world, you know, most notably, for example, like Hal Finney, you know, like the second recipient of the second Bitcoin transaction, right. And you know, yeah, Nakamoto's interlocutor and really, really interesting dude. And for the Extropians, and this maybe gets back to some of the questions of like, what, like thinking about the longer term futures of these technologies, for the Extropians, the agenda that they brought to building digital, their version of digital cash, was the one that just knocked my socks off. Because what they wanted digital cash for wasn't just privacy, wasn't just censorship resistance, wasn't just like ease of transaction or things like along those lines. It was because they had a whole kind of worked out model of the future in which they were going to use digital currencies to so accelerate technological innovation that it would produce a series of scientific and medical breakthroughs that would make it possible for them to live forever. And like, it's just so fantastic to me. And they were like totally committed to this, very deeply engaged with it. And that also meant that they were like very deeply involved with cryonics.
I was just about to say, I'm trying not to step on it, but go ahead.
Yeah, yeah, no, because they, like, if, you know, because they actually faced a really amazing and very painful kind of historical circumstance, which is, what if you know that we are on the verge of these incredible transformations and your, you know, intelligence can be embedded in a cyborg squid, you know, flying through space, you know, for 1,000 years, unless you die first and it's about to happen, but death's going to take you away from it. Well, then you have yourself frozen so you can be brought back. And in fact, some of the earliest like kind of fun side experiments with ideas of what digital cash could be were based on trying to develop certain kinds of asset classes that you could carry forward with you to your like posthumous resurrection.
That's right.
Yeah, and it's really like, and that just, it delighted me for two reasons. I mean, one was that, you know, like, as I'm sure is immediately obvious from the perspective of someone who's writing a history of this stuff, it's like, thank God for these guys, because these people are so much fun to write about, you know, and like so kind of interesting and vital and all over the place, you know, but with a real fire in them. But then the other aspect of it is that they really also show like how big people were thinking about what digital cash could be. And you don't necessarily have to, you know, buy into the full, you know, man into Superman package to kind of think like how, you know, as we're kind of going through this period now, whereas as you and I have been discussing, there's a real kind of rush to try to like institutionalize these technologies in these kind of very in these ways that will turn them into, you know, components within already existing mechanisms of doing things. Like, can we, like, what could we kind of like bring back from this history in terms of the higher order promise, you know, like the potential for bigger transformations, for greater for greater utility, for being able to pull off more big things. Like, what could these technologies offer us from that kind of utopian space that might help kind of pull us more, again, in the direction of revolution?
And that's a perfect, it's just a perfect place to sort of stop for a second, because, you know, I'm thinking, I just want to get people to download a damn wallet.
Yeah.
And say, hey, try to use this. You know, here, let's try to go back and forth and explain what a seed phrase is and so on. But you're absolutely right. Like, I think what animates a lot of the enthusiasts, at least at this stage, is that, you know, not necessarily cryogenics and, you know, living forever, but the idea that this has profound implications. So the book is Digital Cash, The Unknown History of the Anarchists, Utopians, and Technologists Who Created Cryptocurrency. I've been speaking with its author, Finn Brunton, professor at New York University, and the book is out now on Princeton University Press, available in bookstores everywhere, online, Amazon. Buy two copies in case you lose one.
And you guys, bless you. That's wonderful.
I cannot thank you enough for coming on. I've learned so much just sitting, you know, and listening to you talk. Where can people find more of your work and kind of follow you?
They can find me at finnb.net, which is since we were talking about old school hacker stuff, I kind of like just run my own webpage, and that's sort of it. I have like a weird newsletter where I like write research stories from time to time. But otherwise, yeah, people can find my other books there, links to buy Digital Cash, and can always bug me by email, my old school medium of choice.
Well, again, thank you so much for coming on and for doing this, Professor Brunton, and best of luck, man.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a blast.